It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, July 30. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, we hear from the man who pulled a mother and baby from a burning building. Activists decry what they view as police brutality in Minneapolis. The state's congressional delegation backs changes at the VA. GOP governor candidates discuss their plans. MnDOT is faced with what may be its most challenging project ever. And it's the Vikings versus the Birds. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura says he may never be the same, even after a federal jury found in his favor in a lawsuit against a Texas man who claimed to have decked him in a bar confrontation. Ventura said it never happened. He won $1.8 million in a defamation suit yesterday. Today, Ventura appeared on the CBS This Morning program.
You pursue a lawsuit for the truth. I would have been a big-time loser had I not pursued the lawsuit, because of the lawsuit, the whole story was fabricated. I was accused of treason, which in the military is the death penalty. I would think that would be enough to inspire anyone to seek the truth. And the bottom line is, it never happened.
Ventura said he may also seek action against Kyle's publisher in the wake of the federal suit. HarperCollins, the publisher today, said it will remove the passage from the bestseller American Sniper that sparked Ventura's defamation lawsuit. A pair of friends are being hailed for helping rescue a mother and a baby from a burning duplex on St. Paul's North End. Tim Nelson has the story.
Rick Johann was about to have dinner last night, just before 8 o'clock at Tin Cups, a popular bar and restaurant on Rice Street in St. Paul. Then he noticed something wrong down the alley across the street.
I look over and I see smoke, pretty dark smoke. I thought to myself, that's not a barbecue. It's, you know, there's something going on.
The front of a duplex was on fire, a blaze so hot it melted the vinyl siding on a garage across the street. Johann and his friend Stephanie Llewellyn ran toward the flames. Johann said the burning duplex was too hot to even stand in front of it.
I was going to try to get in the front or see if there was any way to access the inside. There was nobody else around. I didn't hear any police sirens or anything, and I figured I had to do something. Nobody else was there.
And he's being called a hero for what he did next. Johann circled around to the north side of the duplex to try to see if anyone was trapped by the fire. He pushed in the screen, drew the curtains aside.
And the woman was standing, holding a baby, looking at me, startled. Started screaming at her, "There's a fire, there's a fire. You gotta get out." And she's like, "Oh my God," like she didn't believe me. She's where, like, you know?
Johann reached in the window and grabbed the baby, a 7-month-old girl. Llewellyn was standing in the alley beside him.
The whole front porch was engulfed in flames, and as soon as I saw the baby come out the window, I grabbed the baby from him. He grabbed her out of there, yep, after the baby got out.
They backed away across the street and watched the duplex burn.
It was like, I've never heard that kind of noise that it was making, all the crackling and I guess the flames. The sound of it is horrible.
Smoke alarms were still sounding in the building's basement this morning. St. Paul Fire Marshal Steve Zachard says the young mother, Lynetta Pryor, and her daughter are lucky Johann acted so quickly.
Would she have gotten out in time by herself? I can only speculate, but what he did was very brave.
Zachard says the duplex just north of Maryland Avenue was badly damaged by the fire and was probably a total loss. He also says officials believe the fire was arson.
This fire was intentionally set, and when you intentionally set fire to an occupied dwelling, you're trying to hurt or kill somebody. I mean, to us firefighters, that's homicide.
Vanessa Pryor lives in the duplex. She says she wasn't there when the fire started and didn't know her sister and her infant niece were even in her home at the time. The other side of the duplex was vacant. Pryor says the fire has left her with not much more than the shirt on her back.
I don't know. I guess the first step to find another place and try to recover as much as I can out of my place. I don't think there's nothing in there recoverable. Looking at it, I don't think I'm going to be able to get nothing out of there. So we pretty much have nothing.
But Johann said he still saw good fortune as he looked at the charred wreckage this morning. He said he'd fully intended to climb in the window to search the burning home when he found Lynetta Pryor standing just inside.
Fortunately, things happened the way they did, and, you know, everybody's safe, and you can replace this house and everything in it, but, you know, the lives, you can't, you know.
Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Dozens of people gathered yesterday in North Minneapolis to express their outrage over the recent arrest and alleged beating of an African-American community activist by police officers. Most of the people who spoke at the meeting have been calling for an end to police brutality for decades. While some of them have clashed over the years, they agree this latest incident shows not much has changed. Brad Williams reports.
Al Flowers' face still shows signs he was involved in a violent confrontation. There are stitches over his right eye and staples in his scalp. Flowers, who is 55, told a group of supporters at the Urban League headquarters in North Minneapolis that he was still in a bit of pain, but he apparently felt good enough to joke with them about his injuries.
I'm a better fighter than this. I just got ambushed, you know. So.
Flowers says Minneapolis police officers beat him up at his South Minneapolis home last weekend. The police report doesn't specify how many officers were involved. Flowers says officers came to arrest his teenage daughter but didn't have a warrant. Flowers says a scuffle broke out after he asked to see it.
And once they attacked, I felt every blow. I felt every 30 to 40 blows to my head, my ribs. I got stumped. And
Flowers has not only had a history of criticizing the police department, he's also sued the city and the department for brutality. He was awarded $15,000 in a settlement in 2008. Spike Moss, an outspoken civil rights advocate, says he believes police officers targeted Flowers because of the color of his skin, not because of what he said about police brutality.
Al took that whooping for us. That wasn't no Al whooping. That was our whooping. That was the hate of us. And folks kept calling me with Spike. Why would they do it? They don't need no reason when you're black. They never answer our questions. Why did you stop me, officer? They never tell us nothing. They just abuse us.
Moss was also angry about Police Chief Janae Harto's response to the incident. Harto declined to comment on the details of the case the day after the arrest. She also did not mention Flowers by name.
Al's incident is not isolated. Those of us who've been around here for a while, you know we've been fighting this for quite some time.
Reverend Jerry McAfee echoed Moss's comments. He says no matter who takes over as chief, the culture among police officers who patrol the streets doesn't change.
You can listen to the police chief if you want. What she say don't always translate to what happens on the block. And until there is a strong move to eradicate that nonsense from the block, nothing will happen.
This is the second major incident involving Minneapolis police officers to spark outrage among members of the African-American community since Harto was appointed. Last year, officers shot and killed a 22-year-old African-American man in the basement of a house after they say he grabbed one of their guns and wounded two officers. As she did in that instance, Harto is asking for calm. The chief spoke to NPR News before the Urban League event for Al Flowers and just after the city's Civil Service Commission upheld her decision to fire two white police officers. The commission found that the officers used racial and homophobic slurs.
We are completing a thorough investigation. All things are looked at, both criminally, civilly, internally. And so I just want people to understand that you have to let the process take its course. And just because the chief and others aren't speaking doesn't mean it's because we don't want to.
But Reverend Jerry McAfee and others at today's meeting say they don't want another internal investigation. They say they want an outside organization to look into Flowers' allegations. Despite their skepticism and frustration with the Minneapolis Police Department, there was at least one sign that there are still ties between the police department and these African-American residents. Lieutenant Rick Zimmerman heads up the Minneapolis Police Homicide Division and works with Flowers' organization called the Community Standards Initiative.
I just wanted to say I'm sorry this happened to you personally, and it'll take time, but I hope you get some justice.
Al Flowers was arrested on suspicion that he assaulted a police officer, which is a felony, and on suspicion of obstructing the legal process, a gross misdemeanor. Officials with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office say no one has been charged in the incident.
Brant Williams on the NPR News Update. Democrats in the Minnesota House are trying to make access to birth control a campaign issue this fall. DFL lawmakers announced a proposal for the 2015 session today that would make it illegal in Minnesota for an employer to deny contraceptive coverage to employees if their health plan covers prescription drugs. The move follows the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that allows Hobby Lobby and other private companies to not cover contraception if the owners have religious objections. DFL House Majority Leader Erin Murphy says she wants the issue discussed before the November elections.
I don't think we should go backwards to a time when women paid more for health care than men for basic health care services. and when essentially being a woman constituted a pre-existing condition. I don't think we should do that in Minnesota. And the Hobby Lobby decision opens up that possibility again.
Many Republicans hailed the Hobby Lobby decision as a win for liberty and religious freedom. All 134 House seats are on the ballot this fall. The four Republicans who want to unseat DFL Governor Mark Dayton have similar goals for the state budget. They want lower taxes and less government spending. But heading toward next month's primary, the candidates are showing some differences on the details of how they plan to achieve their budget goals. Tim Pugmire reports.
On a recent campaign trip to Rochester, gubernatorial hopeful Scott Honor paid a visit to the Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, a drug addiction recovery program. It wasn't long into the tour before Honor began touting his business background.
So I've started a couple companies, and then I built a firm that bought and fixed companies.
Really?
Yeah.
Honor is a businessman and first-time political candidate who wants to approach state government with the same strategy he used in the private sector to turn around failing companies. Honor is proposing to lower and simplify state taxes through a top-to-bottom restructuring. He also wants to cut the state budget by 10%, in part by laying off employees. Honor said he believes there are too many state workers.
You know, the 5 million citizens of this state are being harmed by the fact that the state has too many employees, and the state employees in aggregate are overcompensated. It's an administrative expense in particular. You know, having someone sitting in some function that's moving paper around is not helping this state.
The other GOP candidates also want spending cuts. Former State Representative Marty Seifert wants a 7% reduction, but he said he would reduce the state workforce through attrition. His proposal for what he calls right-sizing government includes merging some state agencies and cutting welfare spending. On taxes, Seifert said he wants Minnesota out of the top 10 in all categories to help stimulate business growth. But he cautioned that tax changes would have to come gradually.
I'd love to promise people, and you know, day one we're going to do this and this with lowering taxes. None of these things happen overnight, but over a four-year gubernatorial term, can we make a glide path to making Minnesota competitive in a place where a destination point and an origination point for inventors and thinkers and those that want to keep their businesses here.
Former House Speaker Kurt Zellers is pledging to veto any tax increase if he's elected governor. He recently emphasized the point by signing the anti-tax pledge pushed by the advocacy group Americans for Tax Reform. Zellers said he also wants to lower all of the state income tax rates.
You're still going to have, you know, a proportion in the top end that's going to pay a higher amount of it. They always have. But it's going to be compressed so that all those folks have an opportunity to have a little bit more of their hard-earned tax dollars in their pocket to invest, not going to the government.
Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson, the Republican-endorsed candidate, said he too wants lower income tax rates to help the economy grow. He said he's also open to expanding the state sales tax, although not to business-to-business transactions. Johnson said a broadening of the sales tax would have to include a lowering of the rate to keep the adjustments revenue neutral.
I know that's really politically dicey, and some people will get mad at me for that, but you can talk to almost any economist, whether they're conservative, liberal, or anything in between, and they will tell you that the best tax policy to spur the economy and grow the economy is one that is low, broad, and simple. So I think we at least have to be willing to look at that, and I would be as part of a bigger package.
Johnson said his plan for state spending will focus on making programs more effective rather than promising across-the-board cuts. He said he would begin by measuring the outcome of human services, which is one of the biggest and fastest-growing areas of the state budget. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Most of Minnesota's congressional delegation is likely to back a $17 billion bill to overhaul the troubled Veterans Affairs Department. The bill comes in response to a scandal at VA hospitals with long wait times for veterans seeking health care and VA officials hiding those statistics from their superiors. The legislation is expected to pass this week in Congress. Brett Neely has more.
If you're a lawmaker who's inclined towards actually lawmaking, this has been a rough session of Congress. This bipartisan VA bill was welcomed by some as a light sprinkle of rain on the long legislative drought. Democrats agreed to give veterans facing long wait times or long drives to VA clinics the choice to seek private care paid for by the government, a shift 2nd District Republican John Klein applauded.
This affords essentially every veteran a choice, because if you're stuck waiting for more than 30 days, you can have a chance to go get a private provider. And if you're being seen in a timely fashion, that's a good thing.
Democrat Tim Walz is the only member of Minnesota's delegation who sits on the House Veterans Affairs Committee. Walz says he doesn't think the move will lead to a flood of veterans leaving the VA system.
My concern, I guess, is making sure the veterans have the access to the best care possible. And in many of those cases, they're going to choose the VA when you talk to them.
The bill provides about $12 billion in new spending to pay for that outside care, to hire doctors and nurses, and lease 27 new VA clinics across the country. None of those clinics will be in Minnesota. Typically, Republicans have demanded spending be cut elsewhere in the budget, but Klein says not this time.
In this case, this is a compromise. We had to do something to address the mess that we now see that the VA is.
The bill also creates a congressional commission to examine the whole VA system. Wall says that's a welcome change from the VA's past practices and may help prevent future scandals.
I think this gives us the chance, and that commission does that. It's okay, we have X number of veterans. Here's where they live. Here's the cost. Here's how many are going to go outside the system. Here's how many are going to stay inside the system. Here's how we budget, and here's how we get efficiencies. I think that has never really happened before, and those are the things that we can do now.
With campaign season set to begin in earnest next week, this is likely the last piece of significant legislation Congress will consider until after the November election. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
MnDOT is studying alternatives for what the department is calling one of its most challenging engineering projects ever. The state has to move Highway 53 outside of Virginia to make way for an expanding taconite mine at a cost that could now exceed $400 million. It may seem crazy to move an entire highway, but it's not as unusual as it sounds. There's a long history on the range of moving roads and even entire towns to make way for mining. Dan Crocker reports.
10,000 cars a day zip along Highway 53, one of the Iron Range's most vital transportation arteries. Just a few hundred feet from the roadway, between Virginia and Eveleth, hidden by a strip of trees, the earth falls away into a mammoth mine pit where four-story tall trucks scrape red ore out of the ground.
If you were in our mine pit now, you would see we are as close to that highway as we can be.
Sandy Karnowski is a spokeswoman for Cliffs Natural Resources, which operates United Taconite. 4 years ago, Cliffs approached MnDOT about moving the highway. When the state first built the road in 1960, it agreed to move it if the mineral rights owner ever wanted to access the ore underneath. So MnDOT looked for options. Virginia and other range towns were furious at a plan to skirt the highway west around Eveleth. MnDOT project manager Pat Houston says almost everywhere else they turned, they ran into a mine pit.
The options are very, very limited, and they're all extremely challenging.
Including where MnDOT is now exploring, deep in the abandoned Richelieu Pit next to the city of Virginia. Mining stopped here in the late 1970s, and the pit has slowly filled up with azure water. 300 feet deep in places, crumbly red cliffs jut out of the water. Workers on two barges are drilling deep into the rock at the bottom of the lake. Houston says the samples will help MnDOT estimate the cost and complexity of building a span across the pit.
If we decide to build a bridge on this alignment, we're going to try to get steel supports down through this old mine fill into hard rock. And what we really want to learn is, what tooling does it take to get down through there? Because this is some of the hardest rock in the world.
The bridge would be the tallest in the state, 200 feet off the water's surface, about the height of the Golden Gate Bridge. So far, the state has set aside $90 million for the project, but MnDOT's current cost projections range from $240 to $460 million. State Representative Jason Metza says he's confident the legislature will find the funding.
It was something everyone was prepared for. We've known about it a long time. You know, our mining companies have moved entire cities before up here.
Indeed, back in 1919, workers began moving the city of Hibbing to make way for a growing mine.
You got a town of around 15, 16,000, and then everybody's got to move. Just picture it. It's hard to grasp, really.
Leonard Hirsch, a member of the Hibbing Historical Society, looks over the vast Hullrust mine pit where the old downtown stood a century ago.
And that was 3rd and Pine Street up there. So that's where the town was, out over the deepest, richest part of the mine.
Further away from the pit's edge, he points out the old foundations of entire houses that were moved.
They would come in, put long timbers under them, and hook it up to a steam tractor and just move them until they got to their foundations.
Moving infrastructure to make way for mining companies continues today on the Iron Range, even beyond the Highway 53 reroute. U.S. Steel is spending about $3 million to move a county highway to make way for an expansion at Minntac, the state's largest mine. MnDOT's Roberta Dwyer says there are about 75 other easement agreements across the Iron Range, like the deal for Highway 53, where the state could be on the hook to move a roadway. Many are not near active mines and would likely be far simpler than the Highway 53 reroute. But one is located next to Hibbing Taconite, under Highway 169 between Hibbing and Chisholm. Cliff spokeswoman Sandy Karnowski says the company doesn't know yet whether it will expand in that direction.
Dan Crocker in Duluth. It's the new Vikings stadium versus migratory birds, and the Vikings seem to be ahead in the game. Audubon Minnesota's executive director says the glass facade of the new Vikings stadium will be a death trap for migrating birds who use the Mississippi Corridor as a flight path. The organization started a letter-writing campaign to get the Vikings and the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority to reconsider. Last week, the team and authority announced they won't be making any changes to the glass because of the cost. But they will take other mitigating steps, such as turning off the lights during migrations. To review their concerns, Tom Cran talked with Sharon Steitler, who blogs at birdchick.com.
This sounds pretty dramatic, to say the stadium could be a death trap for birds in downtown Minneapolis. How many birds would be affected? What are we talking about?
It's hard to put an exact number on this, but we do know that millions of birds fly over the Twin Cities during spring and fall migration, and most of them do it at night, so we don't even see them. So with that kind of impact, and with the stadium being less than a mile away from the Mississippi River, thousands of birds could be killed every year during spring and fall migration.
And what is it, the fact that there's going to be so much glass and that it would be lit, the birds wouldn't necessarily know that it's glass? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, the building's going to be a problem on several levels. I mean, even during the day, just birds that breed around here, you know, cardinals, chickadees, nuthatches, if they're trying to escape a peregrine or a Cooper's hawk, they could be driven right into those windows. As a matter of fact, Cooper's hawks will sometimes drive birds into windows to try and stun them and eat them. Then during migration, if the lights are on, and I know the Vikings are saying they're going to turn the lights off, but are you really going to turn the lights off during a nighttime football game? It gets dark pretty early here in the spring and fall. So birds could be attracted to the stadium. And you know, this isn't a birder versus football issue. I mean, a lot of bird watchers like football.
Sure, right.
We just want to watch football and not have it be at the expense of a lot of really great birds out there.
This has been an issue in downtown Minneapolis before, right?
Yes.
With the IDS Tower and other tall buildings.
Downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis. There's so much that we didn't know about glass, and Audubon has started this campaign called Bird Safe, where a lot of volunteers go out and collect birds every spring and fall to see who's hitting the buildings at night, which glass makes a difference, direction, how close it is to the Mississippi River. And so, yeah, the downtowns are a bit of a death trap for migrating birds, but this is an opportunity for the Vikings to actually help birds.
I just want to talk about the patterns. Let's say, not to get too grim here, but there's a flock of birds. Could they all hit the glass and we'd find the next day just the pavement around the Viking Stadium littered with birds?
You could, but it depends on how early you are out. That part of the problem is that a lot of scavengers that live in the Twin Cities, like raccoons, coyotes, feral cats, they are aware of this, and they patrol this during spring and fall. And so that's one of the reasons why it's hard to tally this, because when those raccoons are hanging out at the buildings at night, it's like it's raining McNuggets for them.
It's like the salad bar is open or the buffet is open.
But
yeah.
There have been cases where like a flock of 300 black and white warblers have hit buildings or cell phone towers. It can be very graphic.
All right. What's the solution here?
Well, here's the crazy thing. They're all different types of glasses. Some of them have UV patterns built into them, so we can't see them, but birds can. But a fairly economical solution for the Vikings is something called fritted glass.
And what is that?
It has patterns built into it, so it doesn't affect our view. And they've done tunnel tests with birds at the Bronx Zoo, where they take migrating birds, they trap them during migration, they put them in a tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel, they'll have regular glass, and then they'll test these different things like fritted glass, and they have a net in front of it, and they let the birds go. And 70% of the time, the birds have known that the fritted glass was there and avoided it.
Oh.
And so fritted glass wasn't developed to keep birds from hitting windows. It was developed to make buildings energy efficient. So this could be a win-win for the Vikings. You know, they could have an energy efficient stadium, which would help their budgets in the long term. And it would also keep potentially thousands of birds from hitting their building every year, which, come on. Come on. The only birds we want to go after Vikings are like Baltimore Ravens, right? Atlanta Falcons, maybe. Seattle Seahawks.
Sharon Steitler, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sharon Steitler and Tom Cran on All Things Considered last night. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for listening to the NPR News Update. I'll be back with the Thursday news.